Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When Hugh McCall was working at North Carolina National Bank, he was building his career, but ideas about Charlotte began to percolate. Later, as head of Nations Bank, those ideas began to take shape. And even though he spent considerable time conquering the banking world by buying up banks and creating the Bank of America, he was also spending time building the Charlotte of today. One cannot exaggerate the impact and influence Hugh McCall has had on our town. When Mr. McCall retired from the bank, though he didn't retire from Charlotte, he channeled his energies into private financial firms and for a while an art dealership, but he also focused on other aspects of building the city. He turned his attention to philanthropy, to social justice issues, and to righting economic disparities. And not just on the macro level. He got his hands dirty, so to speak, spotting talent and nurturing that talent and helping individuals to reach their potential. All of this is the subject of a new book, Beyond the Bank, Hugh McCall's Chapter 2. It's the work of Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Howard Covington, Jr., and he joins us for the hour along with the subject of the book, Hugh McCall. Welcome to you both, Mr. McCall. Welcome back. And also to you, Howard. You've been here before, too. Thank you both for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I'm actually going to begin with Howard Covington. It's surprising me that I'm beginning with Howard Covington, but it's your book. And I'm just curious, after all the research that you did to do this book, did I exaggerate Hugh McCall's contributions or did I understate them?
I certainly didn't exaggerate them. I think I was really surprised as I got into this at how engaged Hugh had become or continued to be in the 20 years since his retirement. He told me as we went along that he had expected just to become another portrait on the wall at a lineup of the old CEO, former CEOs at the bank. But as Michael Marsicano at the Foundation for the Carolinas underscored several times in our conversation together about Hugh, there's no one who could continue to bring together a group in Charlotte just with a phone call. And that his stature and standing within the Charlotte and greater community went far beyond his position as a CEO at the bank.
Does it concern you, Mr. McCall? Should it concern Charlotte that there are no other Hugh McCalls waiting in the wings to take the reins of and do the things that you've been doing all these years?
Well, I don't really think so. I think we have a lot of good leaders here in the city. Lots of young people are putting their shoulder to the wheel and older, more experienced people continue to lead. And I think about people like Pat Rogers, for instance, and I can think of a dozen of people that are making a real difference in the city. And I know there are really hundreds. So I don't worry about that. I think we have lots of energy, lots of leadership talent here in the city.
As your friend, Pastor Bob Henderson, puts it in Chapter 8 of the book, you could be someplace on the Riviera and not worry about a barber shop in Charlotte, the owner of which you helped over the years. You could be doing anything. You'd be spending more time playing golf on your ranch in Texas, hunting. You could be on the Riviera, for that matter, as a matter of fact. Bob Henderson calls this noblesse oblige. How do you see it?
Well, I actually think it's just that I need something to do. And I have always looked at an opportunity, problems as opportunities. And if I think I can solve it, then I try to do it. I try to solve it.
Howard, you have written books about the late Terry Sanford, about the making of the University of North Carolina, about Biltmore Estate, many other topics as well. And you've even written a book about how Nations Bank changed the nature of banking in America. Why this book now?
Well, a friend of Hugh's called me one day out of the blue and said, you need to write a book about Hugh McCall. And I said, why? There have already been two. What would a third add to it? And this was about late 2017. And he said, well, we talked a little bit, and he gave his reasons. And I said, okay, well, I'll go talk to him. So Hugh gave me some time, and we spent actually a couple of hours together on a couple of occasions. And I came away engaged in an idea that came up during our conversation that I didn't have when I went in, which that this is a man who is still discovering who he is and what he wants to do and how he's learning day in and day out and then applying what he learns to his community. And this was particularly true with what he was involved with then and still today in race relations and cross-cultural relationships in Charlotte.
Because you wrote that previous book about Nations Bank, and because of Ross Yockey's book, McCall, which is it's a tome about that thick, about Mr. McCall, how did you approach writing this one? Because there's a lot already known, a lot of stories that are apocryphal and that have been told time and time again. How did you approach writing this?
Well, really with just one rule, and that was this one is going to be another book about a banker. This is a book about a man who's enjoying his retirement and learning from his retirement and continuing to be the person he was at the bank. It's amazing. I found after the riots in Charlotte in 2016, Harvey Gantt were on a Chamber of Commerce panel talking about race relations in Charlotte and the differences gap in the communities. And I found the same speech, almost not verbatim, but very much the same thing that Hugh said on that day that he said in a speech 20 years earlier when he was at the bank. He just had a different platform as a banker, and now he has continued to use that platform in the community, wherever it happens to appear.
This book has not been released yet. It's about to be released
within a week or two, I think.
Okay. And Mr.
Keep
McCall,
my fingers crossed.
I'm told, you just told me before we started that you have not read the book. You've seen sections of it, but you haven't read it. But there have been other books about you, and when you read those books, or when you've read the sections in this book, have you learned anything about yourself?
Well, I guess what I learned is what other people see as opposed to what I think.
Is that disturbing?
No, well, I don't know the answer to that. It's frightening in some ways. But I've tried to make a difference, and it's really, if I had to sum up what I've been trying to do, is to make a difference. And I guess the book addresses some of that as to the difference.
And you spent your professional life making a difference. I mean, in different ways. I mean, you built this bank, North Carolina National, into one of the biggest banks in the country, Bank of America. That's a tremendous effort and vision. You helped build the city of Charlotte by being an influence in where things would go and providing the money for it in some cases when you were at the helm of the bank. And now you've turned your attention to a different way to help people, a completely different way of helping people, as far as I can tell.
Well, I would have to say the key moment for me in the last decade really came with the riots in 16. And so since that time, I've focused totally on race relations. And I'll have to admit, I have learned a lot. And I've changed my mind about a ton of things. And as recently as yesterday, about what I believe about things. And it's learning from other people, learning from their experiences as opposed to learning from mine. And it's been very good for me. And I feel better about myself. Let me put it that way.
How do you explain that about yourself? You grew up in Bennettsville, South Carolina, which is a small southern town, and you had to have been influenced by the attitudes of many people at the time. And I know you moved well beyond that to your the circles you revolved in at Bank of America. But you are part, and pardon the expression, you are part of the old white guy power structure.
Right.
How do you explain your willingness and your ability to change your mind?
Well, I really don't know the answer to that, but I always go back to the Marine Corps and say, it's the Marine Corps is where I learned that everybody pulls their pants on the same way. And that it really doesn't matter where you went to school or who your parents were or what color skin you have, it's whether you can shoot straight. And the Marine Corps changed me a great deal. But I think reading a lot, meeting hundreds of thousands of people, learning from them about their lives, their experiences have changed me. And so I know the truth. I know that I didn't always know the truth. And for instance, to illustrate very quickly, I've been tired of people wanting to tear down monuments and thinking it. And I've said to some of my black friends and that, you know, it's really not accomplishing anything. And I read a book yesterday in which they pointed out that the Confederate statues are not any different from signs that say colored only by on the bathrooms. They're really not heritage items. They're really just, you know, leftovers from a different era that don't matter. And so I've changed my view about that. I'm sure my friends at the Champions will be glad to know I've finally shut up on that subject. But I've learned something. You learn something every day if you let yourself learn.
You mentioned your attitude changed substantially after the riots in 2016, and you're talking about the riots, the troubles here in Charlotte, I believe.
Yes.
What changed your mind about it? How did that open your eyes in some way?
Well, I started talking to people and listening to their experiences, and we formed a group here run by Cy Pugh, who is really the men's auxiliary of the Women's Intercultural Exchange. It's a group of black and white men, and we meet once a month. And basically, what only thing it costs to get in is to be honest about your own views. That is, face up to your own prejudices. And anybody my age is, as you point out, is carrying around all kind of prejudicial thoughts that they don't know they have. Mm-hmm. And those thoughts come unsummoned to you. You'll have a reaction that is absolutely prejudiced. And everybody will say, well, I don't have any prejudice. But of course they do. They just don't know they have. And so it's facing up to those prejudices that first starts on the path to understanding each other and verbalizing. You have to verbalize them and understand them.
And young people today, when they're your age, our age, they will have those prejudices. There'll be different prejudices, but they'll have them as well. But do you think that right now we are on the cusp of something? I have about 30 seconds, but do you think that we're at an inflection point?
Well, I do. And I think we are making good progress. And I think the young people will be the ones that take us through to the finish line.
Hugh McCall is with us. He's the subject of a brand new book by our other guest, Howard Covington Jr., called Beyond the Bank, Hugh McCall's Chapter 2. It will give you inspiration if you're 20 years old or if you're 65 and thinking about, should I retire, about what to do when you give up your current day job, and more. And we'll come back and talk about all of that as well on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Hugh McCall, former CEO of the Bank of America and a major force in Charlotte, is our guest today, along with Howard Covington Jr., who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and his latest book just happens to be about our other guest, Beyond the Bank, Hugh McCall's Chapter 2. Howard Covington, I've had Mr. McCall on this program several times in the past. He actually used to call in a lot off the air, when he was still working at the bank, I think. And just take me to task for certain things. And I've also had the opportunity to do a few events for him at his at Falfurrias Capital. And I have always referred to him as Mr. McCall, never Hugh. And I noticed when I was doing those events at Falfurrias Capital, everybody there referred to him as Mr. McCall, not Hugh. And you say in this book that as you spoke to people for the book, you were struck by the allegiance that remains 20 years after Mr. McCall's departure from the bank among those who worked with him many years ago. There seems to be this tremendous respect for this man. How do you explain it?
Well, I've written books about a number of significant people who made an impact in the lives of folks. Terry Sanford was one. Bill Cecil at Biltmore was another. And then years ago, some leaders at the University of North Carolina. The thing that I was delighted about as I went to work on this book was that when I called people and told them what I was doing, no one failed to return my phone call. Now, I've had a lot of folks who are hard to get and who don't want to talk, perhaps, in connection with research I'm doing. But in this case, everybody wanted to talk about their relationship with Hugh McCall. I think that the reason that that is true is that his relationship with these folks that I was calling upon was real, and it was genuine, and they knew it was real. He is someone who gives of himself to those he works with, who he plays with, who know him in the community, and they want to respond in kind. As someone said, nobody wants to disappoint you. And I think that that came through in my experience in talking. These were strangers. They had no reason to talk to me. I knew some of them from past years, but most I didn't know at all. And they were all up and down, I mean, at all levels of corporate hierarchy and in the community. But I never had anyone fail to return a phone call of mine. And that spoke volumes about Hugh and his position in the Charlotte community.
How do you explain that, Mr. McCall? I mean, you were no pussycat when you were the CEO of the Bank of America. You had a take-no-prisoners approach when you were buying all those banks. But the people around you, and even the people that you probably just nodded to on your way to your office, the people in the bank who would have no reason to really associate with you, have this tremendous respect.
Well, I have no idea exactly about that, but I do care, I did care and do care about the people I work with. And I don't think anyone ever accomplishes anything except through other people. And so I valued the people I worked with and I cared about them. And they, I think, knew that I cared about them. And we won together. I didn't win by myself. I got to stand on the victory stand, but the people I worked with put me there. And I acknowledge that and believe that. And I think you get back what you put out. And so I think people have been good to me because I was trying to be good to them. It's something like that. I don't know.
You left the bank at age 65. Is that your choice, or was that a bank mandate that at 65 the CEO has to step down?
Well, to be more accurate, I left when I was 66. But we did have a 65 mandatory retirement.
Okay.
And the board asked me to stay on one more year, and I did. I was 66 when I retired.
I would imagine you were not ready to leave that bank. I'm just curious, how difficult was it for you to turn over the reins to Ken Lewis? How difficult is it for you now to stay out of, Brian Moynihan's way?
Really, truthfully, not difficult at all. I was ready to retire. I was tired. And I felt like I'd climbed the mountain when I bought the Bank of America. And so I was ready for a different life. And I have enjoyed a different life. And I, for really nearly 10 years, I never went up on top of the bank. I never even went back. I went to my office in the bank at Falfurrias or at McCall Partners at the time, but I never had anything to do with the bank. And even today, I don't really have anything to do with it other than try to help it every time I can. And I don't give advice to the people running the bank. I may ask them for something for some of my young friends that are trying to get ahead. But other than that, I don't have much to do with it. I like what I'm doing. I like being around young people. That keeps you young.
Yeah.
And so the bank was important to me for 42 years, but I have a lot of other things that are important to me now.
But everything Hugh McCall has done, Howard Covington, is based on working with people, with building relationships, with convincing them that they should be joining him in whatever endeavor he has decided is important to Charlotte or important to the bank when he was running the bank. Talk a little bit more about that, Howard. What did you find out about these relationships and his ability to build those relationships?
Well, I was going to say that the when he formed the private equity firm back in the, after he left the bank, not the private equity firm, but the mergers and acquisitions firm, they hired analysts, and these were youngsters, in relatively speaking, who were coming straight out of college, bright as they could be, and they throw them into a bullpen and work the dickens out of them for 2 years, and then they go off and go to graduate school or move on to larger firms. I was struck by the relationship that Hugh developed with these young people who were a third his age. Who were the grunts of the outfit? They were the ones who were there gathering all the details and all the information that the stars like Hugh and his partners would use to make the deals. Yet Hugh would often stop by the cubicles and round up whoever happened to be there and take them to lunch. And they didn't go to the fancy restaurants downtown, but he found the greasy spoons and the hot dog places and the hamburger joints and the other locations out in the community where they would talk about life. A couple of them told me about lessons they learned about their relationship with their wives or the wives to be and building families and things that had nothing to do with making money. And some of those young people are still working with him, beside him today, in different ventures, business ventures, but still as dedicated to being in a partnership with you as they were 20 plus years ago.
We live in a town where we have a tremendous number of newcomers who were not here when Hugh McCall was building and running the Bank of America and are not aware of his significant contributions to what Charlotte has become, because it was nothing. In 1985, you could roll a bowling ball or you could fire a cannon down Tryon Street at 5 o'clock and you would hit nothing, and you could be secure in that because nothing was going on. In fact, I think for a guy who grew up in Bennettsville, Hugh McCall once called Charlotte the most boring town he'd ever lived in, and he made it his mission in life to make it something else, and he succeeded at that. So for those people who are newcomers, Howard, put him into some sort of context for people. It strikes me that there were titans of industry in the 20th century and the late 19th century, like Andrew Carnegie and the Rockefellers, lately Bill Gates, who made not only significant contributions in their industries, but later on in communities they lived in and communities across America. Does he belong in that pantheon in your mind?
Well, I certainly think so. In North Carolina, there hasn't been anybody else quite like him. There wasn't a figure in Raleigh, which is kind of burdened with state government. You don't get anything much done there. Greensboro has withered in the last 20 to 25 years. Winston has had some success, but no one has had the eagerness and the opportunity through their own personal energy and also with the corporation that they happen to run or work for to impact the city quite like you and Bank of America and Nations Bank did over the years. There was a group of others. He was fortunate to have some colleagues who were interested in the same thing. Ed Crutchfield at First Union and Bill Lee at Duke Power Company, Rolf Neal at the Charlotte Observer had a hand in that. And John Belt to some extent. They needed somebody who was really a fire starter. And Hugh was the fire starter. He was the one who said, let's make this town different. And a good example of that, I guess, is the transit center. Now, who would have paid attention to a bus stop, for goodness sakes, which is basically what it was. It was an overgrown bus stop at Trade and Tryon. And it was a hazard and an inconvenience to the riders and to the community and to the people on the street. And that Hugh created using some of his persuasive powers and his bank's money and his relationship with Harvey Gantt, created something that was an extraordinary extraordinary facility for Charlotte and transformative.
You know, it strikes me, we're having this conversation, Mr. McCall, nationally about infrastructure and exactly what constitutes infrastructure and the need for infrastructure. And you spent a lot of time in the bank building what we traditionally think of as infrastructure, buildings, transit centers, helping to put art centers in certain places and art galleries and museums. And now you've turned your attention to a different kind of infrastructure that involves people. And they're helping to pick themselves up by their own bootstraps and give them opportunity. You have devoted a considerable amount of time since retiring to mentoring and advising African-American business people and other minority business people and investing in them. And Howard says that this is something you engage in almost on a daily basis. How did that start? What have you learned?
Well, it really got started when I met a group of young men who were in business and already being successful, and like Todd Collins and James Scruggs and people like that. And I got interested in their businesses and sort of saw a way that I could be helpful to them. And the best way I knew how to be helpful was give them access to things that they were having trouble getting to. That is to people or to loans or to investments. And I've developed a tremendous number of young friendships with these young men. They don't need a whole lot of help. They're smart as all get out. They got a lot of energy. And what they really didn't have was access. And so I don't really mentor them so much as I help them get through doors, find money where they need it, introduce them to people. But I'm engaged with them at about every level, to be honest. I've made some personal investments. The thing that I partnered with two other men to form something called Bright Hope, which is really a private equity firm that only invests in black and brown businesses. And our goal there is to try to help build wealth in the minority community. And any money we make, we're going to plow back in. And so our goals are very simple, and that is to help people up the economic ladder. Now, when I first started out, I was trying to help everybody, and I realized finally that I couldn't do that. And so I've centered my effort on the people that are already doing it well and making it and just need some more capital or some push or help. And that's what I'm trying to do so I can make the most difference in the time that I have left.
We just went through 4 years with the president who touted his deal-making capabilities, and we didn't see much of that on display for the 4 years he occupied 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. But when you were at the head of the Bank of America, and prior to it being the Bank of America, you were a big deal maker. That's how Bank of America came to be. You didn't merge. You bought banks, sometimes very much against their will. How do you scale that down to help these individuals who are dealing with much smaller businesses like barbershops to make the kind of deals that will set them up for success? How do you scale it down?
Well, I think you figure out what it is that needs to be done and then just do it. In other words, size really doesn't matter. What matters is understanding precisely what needs to be done. And we know where to get help. In other words, I know how to ask the young men at Fowl Furious to help me with their brains and in solving a problem. And I turn to them a lot to help me help others. So I don't have to know it all myself. And I know where to go find the answers.
Howard, I have about 90 seconds left, and you call Hugh McCall the poster boy for the sharing of social capital. Expand on that.
Well, very quickly, the social capital is the influence and that you could gain over the years. Just like you put money in the bank, you have these relationships and influence that you can use in the community, and you can use it on yourself or you can use it on others. And Hugh has figured out a way to use that to advantage a lot of other people. You mentioned the barbers. Just a real quick example, a phone call changed their lives after they had come to see him and sit down and talk for what was to be a 15-minute shake meet and greet. It turned into an hour and a half as he dug in to their problems and helped them find a solution. He mentioned some other examples of that, but social capital is using that influence and that understanding of the community to help others.
And it's something we're short on in Charlotte, as we have discovered over the years. We'll come back to talk more about that and other things with Hugh McCall and Howard Covington in a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Hugh McCall is our guest, former CEO of the Bank of America, head of Fowl Furious Capital, several other endeavors, and a mentor. And well, actually, he's in business with two other people now, as he just mentioned, with Bright Star Capital, which is engaged in helping people to succeed, people of less means than normal. We'll talk about that in a second. Howard Covington is also with us. He's the author of a new book about Mr. McCall, Beyond the Bank, Hugh McCall's Chapter 2. He's also written about Terry Sanford and Nations Bank and Biltmore House and the building of the creation of the University of North Carolina. Hugh McCall, Charlotte, for all its growth and all of its accomplishments prior to the pandemic, has had a sad side. It hasn't been much talked about until the social capital survey that came out several years ago that indicated that if you were born poor in Charlotte, it was likely that you would die poor here. And we also knew that although blacks and whites associated at work together, once 5 o'clock came around, they kind of went their separate ways. And that you can't really get ahead if you don't know each other. It's all about relationships. We didn't talk about that. The pandemic has gone on to reveal some severe social inequities. You know that you knew they were there before most people knew they were there. What do you see as this city's biggest problems and the biggest obstacles to overcoming them?
Wow. Well, you know, obviously, we always go back to the same things, which are education, housing, and jobs. And what I've really become convinced of after trying to help in education and trying to help in housing, that the first thing we should work on is training programs and jobs, guaranteed jobs at the end of a 6-month training program. and giving guaranteeing people making to make $35,000 to $45,000 to $50,000 a year coming out of the chute, and let people pick themselves up and build their own, get their own housing and educate their own children. In other words, nothing succeeds like financial success, and that's helped all the rest of us who have been successful. And so I'm now more concentrating on working with the men and women who are providing training and jobs. Now, we all had a lesson from Red Ventures. They started this a long time ago, a training program. And if you pass that test at the end of it, you got a good job at Red Ventures and immediately were lifted economically. I know that Andrea Smith has been doing this at Bank of America, along with Kathy Bessant. They've been training people and providing jobs. And there are many other companies, I don't want to leave anybody out, but there are tons of companies in the city now that are doing that. And that's the best way we can change that picture of no success.
And there are a lot of companies that are not doing that. We're having this big conversation right now in the country about minimum wage, and also about the fact that people are working full time, sometimes two jobs, and are still in poverty. The idea behind capitalism is to make as much money as you can and be profitable. And you were at the head of one of the biggest financial organizations in the country. Is it possible to do what you're talking about, pay people really well to lift themselves up financially and still make a profit?
Absolutely. If you train people, they'll be worth the money you're paying them. And so it really gets down to very intense training programs where you build your own talent. In fact, there's no better talent than the talent you develop for yourself that hasn't been spoiled by someone else. So I think it not only can work, it does work. And there are people that are doing that. And I'm very hopeful that we'll find that as our secret here in this city.
You were a CEO of a major bank. And although Howard Covington writes that you did not make as much money as perhaps some of the other big bank CEOs, you did okay. Right now, it's no secret that CEOs make many, many, many multiples of what the average worker's salary is, and they get much, much bigger raises when they get those raises. And we see the middle class slipping, and we see this unrest in the country, politically speaking, which I think stems from economic disparity. How do we fix that? What's the role of corporate America in fixing that?
Well, I would presume more knowledge than I have. I think that we are going to come out of this pandemic with more streamlined companies, and people should be rewarded more. I think we'll see better pay come out of it. I think CEOs, if you're running a company, there are really just three basics to running the business. And that is, if you look after your own people, they will look after the customers, and that'll look after the shareholders. That is really the formula.
That is it. But why have people lost sight of that? Because early in my career, I worked for a radio station. This sounds ridiculous, but it's true. That was a family. And the idea was you hire good people. You give them, you tell them who we are, and you let them do their jobs, and everything else will follow.
I agree with that. And I think the CEOs, most of the CEOs are getting that picture, understand that picture. And so I think that you'll see that the pay will be there. I think the real issue is we have so many, a big part of our population is left out in terms of training. They didn't get a good education. And we could spend five of your meetings talking about what we've done wrong there. But the point is, it can be fixed, and it will be fixed. People will have to pay to get the talent they want. It's going to be clear. Now, I want to go back to the two men I'm working with, Malcolm Coley and Lloyd Yates. Lloyd Yates was president of Duke. Malcolm runs E&Y. And those are two guys that are really, really successful themselves. They have never quit trying to help others. And you'll see their names everywhere. And Malcolm's involved in everything. I don't know how he does all he does. But so this is not a one-man show. There are lots of people trying to be helpful. So I'm bullish on that.
You're talking about Bright Hope. That's the company, the Bright Hope Capital, that you've formed to help minority-owned companies and to grow Black and Hispanic-owned businesses. In the book, you say, this is business. We are not trying to give away money. We are trying to make money and help people make money. It makes money, and we reinvest it and make things happen. That's capitalism.
Right.
Is it unique? And if it's not unique, why isn't more of this going on?
Well, I think I've been contacted by a lot of people. A lot of people want to get involved. They just don't know how to do it. I mean, there are people, lots of good-hearted people who want to make a difference. And I'm trying to think up a way for them to get involved, create a pool in which everybody can play.
Since leaving the bank, you've been involved in several private equity firms, investment firms, and now this is another one with a different kind of a focus to it. But I'm sure the same principles apply. In other words, how do you, with your investors at Fell Furious Capital, how did you choose which companies to invest in? How are you doing it at Bright Hope?
Well, I'd like to clear one thing up about Fell Furious. I don't run Fell Furious. I'm a retired chairman of Fell Furious also. And Ed McMahon is the managing partner and really the father of it. And the guy that really runs it is Mark Okun. But anyway, we debate it. We have an investment committee. The chairman of it is Chet Walker, who's had done this for the Bank of America for years and is really a brilliant man. And so we gather facts and we talk it out with each other and argue with each other. And that's how we get to a conclusion. But we generally do a tremendous amount of research before we make an investment.
As you were doing research into this book, Howard Covington, and as you were talking to people about Hugh McCall, and as you were talking to Hugh McCall, and I know you talked to his wife, Jane, as well, and she is a force to be reckoned with.
Yes.
what surprised you? What didn't you know that you discovered in the process?
Well, let me follow up just real quickly on that, what you were just talking about. I think the difference here is Hugh's approachability. He is someone who people know, have come to know that they can bring a question to or bring an idea, and he'll want to talk about it and engage with them at some point. Either to tell them, give them some direction to go find help elsewhere, or where they can find help, or dig into it himself. But I think it's approachability that makes a difference. What did it surprise me about Hugh? I'm not sure. There was, well, as you said, I had helped write one book, and there had already been a very thorough Ross Yockey's bio of Hugh was pretty clear. But I think the thing that impressed me the most was his eagerness to continue to learn. I mean, he's 85 years old. He only looks like he's 67, but he's 85 years old. And I was reading today about Frank Gehry, the architect in Los Angeles, who's 92. He says, why would I retire? What would I do? And that's exactly Hugh McCall. Why would I retire? His wife told him after he had been out of the bank not long that he really needed to find something to do after he called her one day and offered to help run errands. So she said, he said, "This I've got to find something for him to do." Well, he was on the way to doing that, but he's well, an energetic and engaged, involved guy. So
I mean, we have been painting this picture of Hugh McCall doing nothing but working for other people, and you do have this Texas ranch that you go to quite often, and you hunt, and you we talked about this before. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it because we talked about it before, but maybe people don't know this. But you stocked the ranch with this particular animal that you and your friends hunt. Are they what are they covinas? Is that what they're called?
No, it's a nilgai, N-I-L-G-A-I, and I didn't stock it. It was brought to Texas by the King Ranch manager back in the early 30s. It's an Indian antelope, runs 300 to 600 pounds, spooks at 1,000 yards, can run 45 miles an hour. And chasing that is one of the most exciting things in the world. And I nearly got killed February when we hit a hole going at 40 miles an hour over the range. And I nearly got thrown off the truck. Anyway, that's what we hunt. We hunt everything.
Okay. All right, we talked a little bit about this before we started this conversation on the air, and I only have a few minutes left, but I think it's important. We seem to have a lot of people in this country today who are very worried about changing demographics and the specter of the shifting of power from one color to another as America browns. And a lot of people appear willing to subvert our democracy in an effort to maintain control, however fleeting that power structure may be. As you were expanding NCNB into Nations Bank, later into Bank of America, you could not have been successful had you not embraced diversity. What do these people who are afraid of it need to know about it?
Well, I have a very easy take on it. I think we're all from somewhere else. We're all immigrants, if you think through it, some just longer than others. And it's not any different from the way the people were in New England when the Irish started coming and they thought, oh my God, we're going to ruin the country. And then the Italians and, you know, we've now had the Poles in Chicago and all the Swedes in Minnesota. I mean, in other words, our country was built on people from somewhere else. And I think we'll do fine. About 50 years from now, people will wonder what were those people uptight about, you know. So I think we'll adjust to it. And part of what will make us adjust to it is just nature. So the laws of supply and demand again. We will find that we see very attractive people that don't look like us. And people will end up getting married and have children don't look like either of their parents. So it's going to be, I think we'll just adjust to it as we've always done it. It's just right now it seems very threatening to some people.
Yeah, and we're going through a period where it's very troubling. Everything about it is very troubling and everybody's hyper-polarized and we can't talk to each other. And yet you are optimistic, which I bet is the source of your success in many ways.
Well, I do believe optimists win. They're not always right. Actually, a lot of times pessimists are right, but nobody follows a pessimist. So optimism really works.
So Hugh McCall has not retired. Howard Covington, you clearly have not retired. What's next? Who are you going to write about next?
I don't have a project pending at the moment, but I'm on the lookout. You got any suggestions?
No. A chapter 3 on Hugh McCall, perhaps.
All right. Wait long enough. Yeah.
So this book comes out when?
I'm looking for copies any day now, but certainly by the middle of this. Well, it is the middle of this month, isn't it?
Yep, yeah. It is.
Within the next week or two.
Okay. The book is called Beyond the Bank, Hugh McCall's Chapter 2 by Howard E. Covington, Jr., our guest, and the subject, our other guest, Hugh McCall. Great to see you again, and thank you so much, both of you, for the hour.
Thanks, Mike. You're on it.
Right. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.